Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present retired U.S. Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who examines President Biden's authorizing Ukraine's use of U.S. weapons to attack targets inside Russia. Senior Airman Juan Betancourt, on active duty in the U.S. Air Force, who talks about the Appeal for Redress campaign to empower service members to voice their opposition to U.S. support for Israel's bloody war in Gaza. And Martha Bosing and Victoria Rue, co-writers and directors of the play Voices from the Silence, who discuss the play they created after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, to tell the painful stories of women who had abortions before it was legal. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While immigration is a top issue in the U.S. presidential election campaign, an escalating water war is brewing between the U.S. and Mexico. As Mexico's president-elect, Claudia Sheinbaum, prepares to take office in October, talks between the two countries are heating up over Mexico's inability to make good on its obligation to deliver water to the U.S. side of the Rio Grande River. Under a 1944 treaty, Mexico is required to send 1.75 million acre-feet of water to the U.S. every 5 years from the Rio Grande. Mexico is suffering through its most severe drought since 2011. The climate crisis-fueled heat and drought, combined with years of overextraction to serve farmers and booming populations, has dramatically lowered water levels. Reduced water deliveries from Mexico, combined with a dearth of rain in the region, are threatening the Texas citrus and sugar industry. U.S. Water Commissioner Maria Elena Haner is pushing for tools to build drought resilience and promote water conservation and efficiency. Meanwhile, President-elect Sheinbaum, a climate scientist, has committed to finding viable solutions to address Mexico's severe water shortage. After the January 2023 police murder of Tyre Nichols, community activists in Memphis, Tennessee, mobilized. Nichols, who was black, was pulled over for a traffic infraction and beaten to death by police. The community pushed the Memphis City Council to ban police stops for minor violations like broken brake lights or a recently expired vehicle registration. The City Council unanimously passed what was called the Driving Equality Act in honor of Tyre Nichols, but that ordinance was recently overruled by the state's Republican majority politicians. Tennessee's right-wing governor, Bill Lee, signed Senate Bill 2573, which blocks cities from enacting police reforms that prohibit or limit the ability of local law enforcement to take all necessary lawful steps to apprehend criminal offenders. Nichols' mother and stepfather called the bill political sabotage. In These Times reports that just 3 months before Nichols' death, a group called Decarcerate Memphis had released a study which found that in Memphis traffic stops between the years 2017 and 2021, black drivers were cited 10% more than their share of the population and were twice as likely as white drivers to receive multiple citations on one ticket. After the electoral success of progressive Democrats known as the Squad, which includes New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee imposed a ban on the hiring of political consultants, media advisors, and pollsters who backed Democratic primary challengers to House incumbents. According to the American Prospect, this blacklist specifically targeted progressive groups and their staff who challenged entrenched conservative Democrats. when Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney took over the Democratic Campaign Committee in 2021, he ended the blacklist, but warned no one should be looking for work around here if they want to go after our members. This year, however, members of the Squad and other progressive incumbents are being challenged by conservative Democratic candidates bankrolled by a $100 million campaign primarily funded by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which receives much of its funds from Republican donors. Ironically, former Democratic Campaign Committee Executive Director Lucinda Gwynne, who imposed the blacklist, is now a media consultant for George Latimer. Latimer is a pro-Israel centrist running a campaign backed by $14 million from AIPAC, challenging New York progressive Democrat Jamal Bowman. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As Russia's invasion of Ukraine entered its 29th month, the Kremlin is seeking to press their advantage in troop numbers and weaponry before newly approved Western military aid reaches Ukrainian forces on the front line. Russia's continued attack on civilian targets, including Ukraine's electrical grid, caused the International Criminal Court to issue arrest warrants for former and active Russian military officials. In a provocative decision made in early June, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized Kyiv to launch some U.S.-supplied weapons at military targets inside Russia. On June 23rd, Russia blamed the U.S. and vowed unspecified consequences for a Ukrainian missile attack on Sevastopol in occupied Crimea, which officials say killed 4 people, including 2 children, with 150 more injured on a Black Sea beach. Russia's defense ministry said the missiles used by Ukraine were U.S.-supplied ATACMS missiles and claimed they were programmed by U.S. specialists. Your reporter spoke with retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State General Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005, who's now a senior fellow with the Eisenhower Media Network. Here he examines the Biden administration's policy authorizing Ukraine to use U.S. weapons to attack targets inside Russia, and the outcome of a mid-June peace summit sponsored by Ukraine in Switzerland.
I cannot believe that anyone in the United States, Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, anyone, authorized Ukraine, for example, to fire that ATACMS missile, an American-provided missile, at the beach in Sevastopol. It had to be programmed most likely on the ground by an American, either a civilian technician or an American military member in Ukraine. So I don't think the Ukrainians are capable of doing that yet. So this is very worrisome. Did the White House know that they were going to do this? Did they know about the target selection? Because Putin is extremely angry about it. I don't blame him a bit for being angry. The Crimeans are out on the beach, and a missile comes in and kills civilians. This is not a part of the war. It's not an understanding of what's in the war and what's not in the war. And so he can choose to reply asymmetrically, and he's got every right under the laws of war to do that. Now, how is he going to respond? Well, he could respond by hitting a NATO country. He could respond by hitting facilities in NATO countries that are supporting Ukraine. He's always had this capacity. He's always, under the laws of war, had the right to strike anything outside of Ukraine that is supplying directly support for Ukraine and killing Russians. And he's refrained from doing that. I don't think he wants a war with NATO, but he is fully prepared now to do that if he has to. And that includes his nuclear weapons, and not just the tactical ones, but the strategic ones, too. We forget sometimes that the only two countries in the world left with 5,000 plus nuclear warheads, and Russia has more than 6,000, are the United States and Russia. So this is extremely dangerous to be doing these sorts of things with that kind of escalation potential.
Colonel Wilkerson, Ukraine organized a recent peace summit in Switzerland, June 15th through the 16th. More than 80 nations were represented at the summit, but they did not sign on to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's maximalist position, demanding Russia's withdrawal from Ukraine and war crimes trials and a lot else. Given that path doesn't look very productive, what role should the Biden administration play right now in supporting peace talks to end the war in Ukraine?
The first thing Biden should do himself is authorize Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, to talk to his counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Russia. There is a verboten rule on both Jake Sullivan and Antony Blinken. They cannot talk to Sergei Lavrov. And, of course, Biden's not going to talk to Putin. This is wrong. You do not bar your diplomats from speaking to your enemies, potential or otherwise. You want to speak to your enemies more than you want to speak to your friends, actually, especially if you're at war. So this is a nonsense business that we're playing with no diplomacy allowed because of our hatred for Putin. And as for the peace conference, it was a farce. Most really important people, like, for example, the most powerful country in the world right now, China, did not come. And they did not come for a very obvious reason. And it was stated by Wang Yi and others, Russia wasn't going to be there. So if you have 50% of your antagonists in a war not present at a peace conference, how is it a peace conference? And as I understand the results of the 10 issues Zelensky wanted to be on the table, they did talk about each of them, but the only three they made any edicts about or decisions on were the three they said they were going to deal with, and that was food safety and food security, return of children, particularly Ukrainian children that were captured by the Russians, and nuclear safety, which I applaud. So they didn't talk about anything really serious, and one could imagine that they wouldn't. They weren't accompanied by half of the war, if you will. Russia was not there. Absolutely absurd conference, really, if you think about it. I've been paying attention to some very sophisticated polls lately. A small majority, about 52-53%, if you trust the polls, are now dissatisfied with the Ukraine war. They are not necessarily fans of Vladimir Putin or Russia, but they don't think we're doing the right thing. They'd like to see us get out of the Ukraine conflict. So that means the major reason for Joe Biden staying in it come hell or high water, that is his reelection, because he didn't want to be seen as cutting and running from a conflict that he had declared was existential to the future of Europe. So why is he persisting if the majority of the American people now are with me, at least in some ways, that this is a stupid conflict and that we shouldn't even be in it?
That was retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Chief of Staff to Secretary of State General Colin Powell from 2002 to 2005. Find more analysis and commentary on the Ukraine war and current peace efforts by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Israeli military continues its onslaught in Gaza, the death toll of Palestinians now totals more than 37,000, with another 86,000 wounded in the war that began after Hamas militants attacked Israel on October 7th. In response to U.S. support for Israel's Gaza war, supplying weapons responsible for thousands of Palestinian civilian deaths, an increasing number of U.S. military and State Department officials have resigned in protest against America's role in this conflict. Appeal for Redress Version 2 is a new campaign initiated by active duty military members, veterans, and GI rights groups to allow American service members to tell their elected representatives why they're opposed to U.S. policy in Gaza. The campaign is modeled after the 2006 Appeal for Redress that was conducted during the unpopular U.S. occupation of Iraq. Your reporter spoke with senior airman Juan Betancourt on active duty with the U.S. Air Force while seeking conscientious objector separation. Here he talks about the Appeal for Redress campaign and explains why he's opposed to U.S. support for Israel and its war in Gaza, declaring, quote, "It's our responsibility to humanity and the principles we hold dear to speak up against these heinous acts and make it known to our elected officials that we will not stand by silently while genocide unfolds."
Before I begin, I want to clarify that any views that I express during this interview are my own and not those of the Air Force or the Department of Defense. So about 3 months ago, soon after I decided to become a conscientious objector and started working for Veterans for Peace and got in contact with Mike Ferner, at the time their director, we began to think about ways in which the organization and other peace movement orgs that are allied with Veterans for Peace can come up with a campaign to help and assist active duty Guard members into expressing their frustration, their moral outrage at the ongoing genocidal onslaught in Gaza, which is backed by the United States government. So it is, in a way, influence and an inspiration from their original 2007-2006 appeal for redress, which was geared towards the highly unpopular invasion of Iraq at the time.
Are the goals simply to allow active duty servicemen and women to express their views on U.S. policy when it comes to U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza, to speak openly with their congressional or senatorial representatives? Is that the goal here?
You're absolutely right. That is the goal. This is protected speech. This is within our rights. It is quite common for active duty members to write to the representatives for a variety of issues, but often military members are frequently used as pawns in a game of American politics, with our beliefs and personal experiences manipulated for agendas that bear so little connection to our reality, but that have historically placed us in peril. So this is an opportunity for members to express that outrage and to, in a way, you know, within the legal boundaries of military code, express that outrage, that dissent, but within legal boundaries.
So as you mentioned here earlier, you no longer wish to serve in the U.S. military due to its role in the Gaza war, and you're actively now seeking conscientious objector status from the Pentagon. Tell us a little bit about how you reached that decision and what's happening in Gaza that provoked you to want to leave your U.S. military career in the Air Force.
So I've been apprehensive in my role in the military for quite some time, even predating the genocidal onslaught that began on October. But as last year came to a close, I just could no longer keep quiet about the war crimes being committed by Israeli troops in Gaza with the backing of the United States government. And it was the IDF's barbaric tactics, the genocidal language of their commanders that just reached unprecedented heights. And we were all witness to what was going on through our smartphones and other media reportings. And I understood then that what laid ahead would be unlike any previous assault on Gaza Strip. And since then, I've written dozens of letters to elected officials and even a letter to the White House chief of staff. And it made it clear in these early letters and conversations that if I were assigned a mission that, you know, directly supported Israel in any capacity, I would refuse orders regardless of legal consequences. So that was really my beginning in dissenting, speaking out against the war crimes being perpetrated in Gaza. And then an important turning point, a catalyst, if you will, was in February when Aaron Bushnell self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy. And his tragic death was a turning point for me because I began to question seriously my participation in the military. My conscience was developing in a way that made it impossible for me to continue. And it strengthened my resolve to speak out, especially after attending his funeral here in Lackland Air Force Base, where we were both stationed. I never met Aaron, by the way.
And just a final question before we say goodnight, Airman Betancourt, and that is, if you had the opportunity to sit down with a member of Congress, either a representative or a senator, in just a few short words, what would your message be to that representative who has the power to vote for or against U.S. policy when it comes to current U.S. support for Israel and its war in Gaza?
I would tell them what I've been telling my peers, people that I meet in the street, people that have messaged me in support. I would ask them to look deep within their conscience and stand against this unspeakable carnage. I would ask them, what kind of legacy are we leaving for our children and grandchildren? Do we want them to grow up in a world where mass killings are live streamed and just accepted as normal, where the dehumanization of certain groups is just taken as just a day-to-day action? Is that the world that we want them to inherit? Is that the legacy that we want to leave behind? I say it's not, Scott. And this is the moment where we must hold steadfast to our values of humanity and solidarity, both at home and abroad, and we cannot turn away and be complicit in these atrocities.
That was Senior Airman Juan Betancourt on active duty with the U.S. Air Force while seeking conscientious objector separation. Learn more about the Appeal for Redress campaign and U.S. soldiers opposed to America's role in Israel's war on Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This week marks the second anniversary of the June 24th U.S. Supreme Court Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, that for nearly five decades had protected Americans' constitutional right to abortion. After the court ruling, two women living at the Rossmore Retirement Community in Walnut Creek, California, began working on a play whose script derived from the painful stories of women now in their 70s to 90s who had abortions before it was legal, meaning before Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. Some of those same women also acted in the play. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with the creators of the play, titled Voices from the Silenced. The two co-writers and directors of the play are Martha Bosing, a retired artistic director of a professional women's theater in Minneapolis, and Victoria Rue, a Roman Catholic woman priest who also wrote and directed many plays. Here they describe the process of creating the play, with support from the American Medical Women's Association, which is now distributing a video of the play nationally. We hear first from Martha Bosing.
When we decided to do this, Victoria really talked about getting stories from women here who had had abortions before the Roe decision, which had circumstances going very like what's going on today. And so we did that, and we based the play, we wrote the play around that concept of these stories. Well, the actors were cast out of auditions and were not all, some of them, their stories were in the play, but many of them were not. We were taking the stories from these stories. I think that that's what made the whole group so engaged in this and so engaged with each other, is that the issue was important in everybody's lives. They just felt that they knew people. If they had not themselves gone through this with even back alley abortions, they knew people who had. We have a good friend who lives here who's a wonderful painter and artist and works with paper and glue and stuff. And she made six puppets or heads of people from SCOTUS, from the Supreme Court. And they came in early in a little trough where they could be standing up and loomed over the whole play watching it. And there's a scene with them with actual comments made by the Supreme Court justices about Dobbs.
The play is divided up into five sections. The first section of the play is called Shame. And we all know that that was really key to women who were not telling their stories prior to this, out of shame. And the second section is called The Decision Itself, which is very much about all the issues that come into play, such as when you're making this decision to have or not have an abortion, poverty, am I going to be able to feed the children I already have? Can't afford an abortion itself, including shame. And a third section is called the abortion, and those are stories, many of which were back alley abortions, abortions in Tijuana, for example, and botched abortions. And the fourth section is grief, a grief ritual, which is really a lamentation, sorrows and grief. And then the fifth section is resistance, which I think connects the whole play. And it's really based on the success of the women in Argentina, Colombia, and Mexico who have voted and gotten others to vote for reproductive freedom. I think there's a line in the play that says, they tore down the laws that criminalized abortion in those countries. And as we know, there are many other countries now who also have decriminalized abortion. Yeah. We performed it at Rossmore, where Martha and I both live. And the woman who produced the play for us here at Rossmore had friends who were in the film world, Mindy Zuckerman. And she got all of those people to come and film the play. Martha and I are talking about the play, but what people are going to be able to see when they go to our website, which is voicesfromthesilence.com, what they're going to be able to see is the play that has been edited by Gary Weinberg. And that play is taking advocacy theater that is visually reimagined in this 57-minute film. And he's done extraordinary work. So I'm hoping that people will watch the 57-minute film of the play, and they can show it to their friends. They can use it however they want to use it. Just go to the website. It's free.
So what's your message to women of childbearing age, or to politicians even? What is, and maybe they're different messages.
If there was any wish we had behind this whole experience, is that it will move people, particularly maybe undecided people or people that are saying, I don't think I'll bother to vote, who would see this and realize, I've got to go vote. And I've got to vote for the women who are in such suffering right now. I've got to vote for them so that we get politicians in the government who will not go with all the things that are happening in the states and make a federal law that women have the right to choose. They'll bring rollback.
That was Martha Bosing and Victoria Rue, co-writers and directors of the play, Voices from the Silenced. To learn more about the play and watch a video of the performance, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KGHI in Westport, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.